Hi, welcome back to Law and Legitimacy. This is Norm Pattis. As always, thanks to Mike Boyer of the Kraft Carolina Legal Group for his amazing technical support. I could not produce this podcast without him, or if I could, I wouldn't produce it as well. If you enjoy this, please consider giving us a 5-star rating on the vendor that on whose site you listen to this. Give us a positive review. And if you really like what you're hearing, consider supporting me on Patreon or making a contribution to our efforts. Free speech isn't necessarily free. In an era of cancel culture, being outspoken has its costs. Your support helps me bear those costs and continue to be a strong and independent voice. A voice for what, you say? Well, today I'm advising all of you to go out and buy a new wallet. That's right, W-A-L-L-E-T, a new wallet, as in the thing you keep in your pocket or purse to stuff all your identification cards and other things with. Why? Because I think you're going to need a new ID card soon, your so-called social utility score card. That is, the card that is embedded with a computer chip that permits a vendor or seller of goods and services or provider of government services to plug your card into a computer or scan and otherwise get a score for you about your social utility, whether you're a good citizen or not. They do that in China right now, and the social utility score will dictate whether you get access to certain goods and services or how much you pay for goods and services if you have access to them, if you've not been denied access. What has me persuaded we're about ready to get them? Well, there's no concrete proposal to require them in the United States yet. But the constellation of factors pushing in that direction seems overwhelming to me. It only seems a matter of time until we're issued such cards. Why do I say that? Well, consider the announcement this week by City of New York Mayor Bill de Blasio of the new Key to New York City Pass program. Here's how de Blasio announced it. He said, and I quote, "This is a miraculous place, literally full of wonders." I'm referring, of course, to the city of New York, continuing with Mr. de Blasio. "If you're vaccinated, all that is going to open up to you. But if you're unvaccinated, unfortunately, you will not be able to participate in many things," close quote. This is part of a new New York City initiative to require the city to impose regulations on dining facilities, that is restaurants and offering indoor dining, gyms and movie theaters. If you don't have a vaccination, if you don't have proof of vaccination, you're not going to be served. And proof can come in a number of forms. It can come either from using the city, a new digital app that the city will have on your iPhone or electronic device that would permit the city to scan proof of your vaccination into some centralized database, or the state's Excelsior app. I'm not sure I know what that is, but presumably it's some state-sponsored application that keeps track of your papers, or a paper vaccination card. If you have these things, then the good things that the city has to offer in the form of indoor dining, access to a gym, movie theaters are accessible to you. If you don't have them, then you can't enter. Wow. I never thought I would see a day in the United States of America when you were required to show papers of any sort in order to obtain access to goods and services. Now, is this a bad thing? In my view, it is. But plenty of people think it's a good thing, because there is a growing and increasingly contentious debate about how the relationship between vaccinated and unvaccinated people should be managed, especially at a time when the Delta variant of the COVID-19 virus is flourishing and is taking an increasing toll on unvaccinated people, and even a toll in so-called breakthrough cases on some vaccinated folks. The fear is that the failure to vaccinate, a person's refusal to vaccinate, exposes us all to risk. And this raises the classic problem of so-called self-regarding acts, and whether state regulators and state regulations have the legal and moral authority to reach self-regulating acts or self-regarding acts. And what am I talking about here? The classic example is motorcycle driving. It is in the state of Connecticut, from which I broadcast. People are not required to wear a helmet in order to drive a motorcycle. And the argument about in favor of helmetless motorcycle driving is that that is a self-regarding act. A driver of a motorcycle who hits a bump, crashes, and smashes his brains out onto the highway hurts only himself, the claim goes. However, we know better. Those of us who have attended funerals of friends who've died in collisions know that in the wake of a death, there are mourning family members and community members left to pick up pieces and to move on without the provision of care, support, and whatnot that the decedent took with him to the grave. Arguably, there are no such things as self-regarding acts. No man, after all, is an island. Don't ask for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for the guy who smashed up on his motorcycle on the interstate. Well, okay. What does that have to do with vaccination? I have chosen to be vaccinated. I rely largely on my wife and my son, one of my sons who's a medical professional, to advise me on what to do and not to do with respect to vaccination. I don't find the topic very interesting. I've got other things to do. And candidly, I view this whole COVID experience as little more than a dystopian nightmare. I look back on the great period of lockdown as the world's longest bad weekend, and I shudder to think that there may be another one to come. But I listen to their advice and I take it. So I was vaccinated early, and I am hoping to get a booster shot when and if they become available. I understand the risk of vaccination. I understand that in even a well-tested and well-vetted vaccine, there is some small statistical chance that I will or a loved one will be injured and perhaps die. And I understand that under federal law, there's a vaccine fund for those injured as a result. And that fund operates largely as a workers' compensation pool. In other words, it's understood that certain people will be injured and that they're entitled to compensation, but that the overall public benefit of vaccination outweighs the individual and infinitesimal risks to some individuals. Okay, I get it. So I took the vaccine and hoped that I wouldn't die or get seriously ill. And I didn't die, and I didn't get seriously ill, and I've been out and about for the last 6 months, and gratefully so. I have colleagues, though, including people in my office, who refuse for religious reasons to take the vaccine. Some of the vaccine researchers have relied upon stem cell derived from fetal tissues, and those who take a view of the sanctity of life that prohibits the use of fetal material in such a way, fetal material coming from abortions, they're entitled to my respect and support, and they have it. No one is required to be vaccinated to work in my office, even though I understand that that imposes some risk on the rest of us. There is a growing intolerance for that point of view. If you look at yesterday's New York Times, I'm referring to the August 4th New York Times, the front page story read, "Vaccine proof needed to dine indoors in city. New York getting strict for activities inside." Several New York residents were interviewed, and one of them said the following. And I believe this was United States Representative Adriano Espaillat. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing the last name correctly, but it's Espaillat. And then James Sanders, Jr., a state senator. I believe Mr. Sanders said the following: "You have the right to your body, of course, but you do not have the right to kill other people. A strong stance needs to be taken," he said. Another person, this one, Camelia Rinaldi, a former line cook at Marta in Manhattan and now a sous chef at the Great Jones Distillery, said, "This is about public health. So if you are entitled not to have the vaccine, and I am entitled to have the vaccine, I'm also entitled to not want to be around you because I am taking care of myself and taking care of the whole community." So in other words, Ms. Rinaldi and those favoring the New York program take the probably correct view that there are no such things as self-regarding acts. And they say that in the name of public health, if you want to play in public, among the rules you have to abide by are not just the simple rules of criminal law: do not kill, do not steal, do not rape, do not rob, do not pillage, do not plunder. But now the more refined and demanding requirements of public health. get vaccinated if you want to play in public. And if you don't want to vaccinate, you can't play. I don't know. I'm just not prepared to go that far. I find it chilling. I find it chilling because I think of my colleagues who, for religious reasons, refuse to vaccinate. And I think of the Bill of Rights. And I think of the Bill of Rights, in particular, the First Amendment, and its limitations on what government can and can't do. We're guaranteed freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, freedom to petition for the redress of grievances. And nowhere in the federal constitution do I see the right of government to cram down a vision of the good on all people. I guess I buy the view of the night watchman state, that the government's role is not to promote affirmative visions of the good, but to prevent private visions of the good from imposing evil on others. I stand with Antigone in Sophocles' great play by that name. Antigone, you will recall, wanted to bury her brother. Her brother defied King Creon and engaged in sedition and died as a result. Antigone wanted her brother buried, a sacred ritual to the ancient Greeks. In the absence of a burial, his soul would wander unattended. And that was a grievous result, and families owed to the dead a good death and a good burial and a ceremonial burial. No, said King Creon, you cannot have it. He violated the laws of the state, and the state will punish him by refusing he and his family the right, he had a decent burial, his family the right to bury him. Antigone resisted and defied Creon in one of the classic statements of individual conscience and liberty, a statement that has inspired the West for now millennia. And she told Creon, there are some laws higher than your laws, dear king. You are but a man who rules by fiat and by what he can and cannot do in the community at large. But there are higher laws. Those higher laws are God's laws, we say, or some of us say natural law. Those who are agnostic and claim no knowledge of God or nature's impediments nonetheless value a limited state and say that there are limits on what a state can and cannot do. And thus a state that pretends to tell us how to take care of ourselves, to impose limits on the acts we must commit to care for ourselves, takes on itself too much power. I think that's what we're on the cusp of with respect to the whole COVID-topic dystopia. You know, I've grown fascinated by dystopian literature and am rereading the great classics of dystopian literature just now. I'm talking about Orwell's 1984. I've read that recently. Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, the works of Philip K. Dick. I'm now reading Margaret Atwood, Handmaid's Tale, Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. And in each of these stories, I refer to them as social science fiction. With a great art of a science fiction writer is to take some feature of the known universe and place greater weight on it than current experience or expectations warrants. Thus, we can have time travel, or we can have objects suspended in space, or we can have extraterrestrial or extrasensory perception. And when you weight that individual variable, you expand the scope of consciousness. You delete the requirement of weightfulness or suspend gravity. You suspend our normal experience of time is always moving forward and in small increments. You can do marvelous things in fiction. You can imagine worlds that are possible but don't exist, and then you can play out the consequences of what it would be like to live in those worlds. That is the function of science fiction. Dystopian literature, by contrast, I will refer to as social science fiction. You take some vision of the good or some element of what a good life is and overvalue it to the point of diminishing other things, and you empower a state to enforce a vision of the good on people, and you end up with universes, worlds, social worlds different from the ones in which we normally live, and you get to try on a universe filled with people with differing priorities. But a funny thing happened on the way to utopia. Each of these novels, each of these presentations of a good life, each of these presentations of the community gathered together by a different conception of right, but empowered, but with officials empowered by the state to impose this vision against of the good on all, they all end up with individual dissenters, individuals who refuse to play the game, individuals who decide that individual significance, small relationships, a sense of satisfaction, a sense of personal accomplishment, a sense of personal accountability and responsibility matters more than this common vision of the good. And these small individual voices always end up shedding an unfavorable light on these utopias, and they become dystopias. Because what we learn is that a society that sacrifices the individual to collective visions of the good soon loses any sense of significance for the individuals living within it, and people become something other than agents acting on their own behalf. They become tokens in a larger game, and those tokens take the spice out of life, as it were. So I think we're on the cusp of that now in the United States, and here's my proof. Look at what's going on in the New York key to the New York City case. De Blasio is saying, you know, we have wonderful things in the city. If you want to enjoy them, you have to do what we want. People are prepared to accept it because they've become risk intolerant. You have a right to do what you like, but I have a right to do what I like. And if your right conflicts with mine and imperils mine, then I'm going to impose my will, my right, my vision of the good on you. And people are prepared to accept it. At some level, I suppose I am too. I wouldn't want some guy with florid COVID walking into my office, coughing all over me, saying, I think the virus is a hoax. And oh, by the way, I'm sorry if you catch this common cold we share. I want protection, but I'm not sure I want that protection at the expense of individual liberty. And here's why. A public health state, which is what we are verging toward, is a state run by experts. It's a state run from the top down with a vision of the good imposed on dissenters over and against what the dissenters say. You don't have to agree. You simply have to comply. You don't have to consent, but you must obey. And that silent, surly consent, that passive walking, bellowing, mooing with the crowd will transform us from a people wherein life has spice because of the decisions we make into a formless, tasteless glob of gelatin in which the mob governs because the mob has the will and the power and the will to power sufficient to cram its vision of the good down anybody's throat. Here's how it's going to play out. We'll begin with these cards in New York. And then we'll see, and there are already individuals that are calling for censorship of people with unpopular ideas, deplatform them. Banks ought not to loan money, for example, to people who manufacture guns because guns are a, what, you heard it here first, or maybe second, third, fourth, or fifth, a public health crisis. That's the new mantra. Whatever is a public health crisis must be managed and controlled in the name of the public good. So if there's a manufacturer of guns, a possessor of guns, a person who's involved with guns, deprive them of credit, deprive them of the ability to do business, deprive them of the ability to advertise, and you can drive them out of the community. Similarly, we end up with similar claims that systemic racism is a public health problem. Recall during the summer of 2020, during the pandemic, when we were all supposed to be locked down, visions of people in the streets, cheek by jowl, protesting the death of George Floyd, claiming that this was a time of racial reckoning. More than one public health official supported those rights to aggregate in ways that were prohibited. You couldn't go to church, you couldn't go to your grandmother's funeral, but you could go and dance and party in the street, maybe throw a Molotov cocktail or two, all in the name of social justice. And that's because systemic racism was killing so many people in the views of these professionals, the incidental carnage that came of too much social contact in a protest was a price worth bearing in the long run, because if it made a better society, it would be a healthier society in the long run. Put another way, you have to break a few eggs to make an omelet, and if some of those eggs broken were people broken because of COVID acquired during pandemic or during protests during the pandemic involving George Floyd, oh well, the good required that. But here's the granddaddy of them all. Isn't climate change an existential crisis? The concept of an existential crisis is one that is so grave that it imperils the ability of a civilization to continue at all. And so to save our common lives, or the lives we idiosyncratically enjoy in the communities we call home, ought we not to impose in a top-down manner whatever is necessary to save our ability to feed ourselves, to house ourselves, to continue to love one another and to procreate? Shouldn't we engage in top-down control of all activities in the name of climate change? shouldn't Greta Thunberg, you know, become our guardian? No, nobody gets out of here alive. Life is risk. It is appointed unto men once to die, the good book says, and I think death comes for us all. I don't seek it. I don't want it. I will resist it so long as I have the means. But I don't want to force the illusion on others that we can live forever or that we can live well and better for a longer period of time if we all sacrifice the liberty that each of us have to make mistakes, mistakes that hurt ourselves and others. Now, in the criminal and civil law, there are some mistakes that bear social consequences. Both the criminal and civil law set the minimal conditions of civilized life together in a community. We permit people to do only so much without consequence, cross certain lines, and there will be consequences. That's okay, and we can argue about what those consequences will be. But with respect to the New York vaccination card requirement to enjoy public places, that is a step too far. And I think it needs to be rolled back because we're one step closer to communist China now. And that's a world in which what you view online, what books you read, what movies you watch, where you go, where you work, what taxes you pay, what newspapers you read, all of these things can be tracked online in a profile generated of you. Are we really and truly prepared to let those profiles determine what access to goods and services we have in the future? China has made the decision to do so. New York's chilling use of vaccination cards as a requirement for access to public places tells me we're one step closer to China's vision of totalitarian control of individual expression. I do not want to carry a card to eat in a dining room in New York City. I hope you don't either. Thanks for listening to Law and Legitimacy. This is Norm Pattis. Again, thanks for listening.